This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Are we headed for collapse? A study partly funded by NASA says a combination of crises could bring down the global system we count on. It's not guaranteed to happen, and we can't know when, but the world's supply chains, just in time, make the possibility of a sudden unraveling more possible. Would you believe everything from food to power to gasoline could disappear in just a matter of weeks? There is a small industry of pundits warning something is about to collapse, a large and growing public who suspect they are right. It's hard to pin down what sets analyst David Corowitz apart from the pack. Maybe it's his detailed big picture outlines that make sense. Is that why he's in demand across the world, advising governments, sometimes business and nonprofits alike? And strangely, most of those organizations could become quickly dysfunctional if David Corowitz is right. It doesn't hurt that David is based in Dublin. Ireland just went through an economic beating ahead of us all. He's part of an organization called FISTA. He advises governments there sometimes, and he runs his own business called Human Systems Consulting. We're going to talk about two of his papers that explain why fragile systems, from the economy to the environment, could fall apart much faster than we think. David Corowitz, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you very much, Alex.
How has the Irish experience helped you see a few things?
Well, I think the first point to be made is while the narrative in Ireland has been we've come through a great shock, in broad global terms, even at the worst of what's been happening over the last 5 years, you know, 70% of the world would look and say, well, that's looking pretty all right. So if you're on an unemployment benefit, you can eat reasonably well, you'll get shelter, etc. Our systems are working, our governance is working, etc., etc. So when we talk about being hit by a crisis, it's very much in relative terms. And I think now people are feeling, and the narrative is, because unemployment is starting to fall again, people, there's more confidence around that people are saying, well, we've come through a storm, we've weathered it, and we're starting to find the bottom and work our way up. But again, what the experience highlighted to me certainly was even how a small drop in real terms in economic growth in a very rich country can seem to the people through their own perceptions like a huge traumatic shock, which really in global terms or historical terms, it's not really.
Why did, briefly, the Irish society survive its flirtation with utter bankruptcy?
Well, why did it survive? I think one of the things is we're a small country, which kind of helps. We have quite a bit of societal trust. And by that, I mean, even if people complain, which of course they do, there is a general sense that the government in power might be stupid, it might be this, that, or the other. But by and large, I think it's seen that governments and societies are working for more or less the good of society. Not that they're perfect, but just that there is that level of societal trust. So I think that's an important thing because it helps to carry, you know, trust is a great thing for carrying a difficult choices. The other thing is certain things were protected. So basic levels of social welfare, for example. And I think another thing was that the government, even though banks were bailed out and we still have far more debt than we could ever expect to pay, that in the broad sense, I think the policy of the government was keep the ship steady, A, and B, try and distinguish ourselves as much as possible from Greece in particular, from Spain or Portugal, try and get a narrative out that Ireland is different. And of course, one of the things about financial systems, economic life is confidence is at its heart. So that sort of narrative from the government side of separate out this, make a big gulf between what were known as the rest of the pigs and Ireland, was an important strategic move that they made that kind of worked. Another thing is we've a reasonably broad-based economy. So traditionally, of course, we've got agriculture, but even off our agriculture, there's large agribusiness. And then there's big, you know, European headquarters of American firms like Facebook and Google, etc. So I think, you know, all of these things played a part in sort of avoiding calamity. I mean, one of the things I think, you know, in counterpoint to what I've just said is if you look at Greece, it really seemed with very little societal trust. You know, there had been endemic problems that we didn't face. For example, large-scale tax avoidance or really endemic corruption.
Right. Nobody stormed the barricades or even put up flames in the central square or went after the prime minister's house, I presume. Now, moving on YouTube, I watched one of your lectures. It was titled The Modern Economy, Civilization, Complexity, and Collapse. And you began with a picture of life in Kyrgyzstan and in how that local and resilient economy will likely be sucked into our globalized scheme like everybody else. Won't they be better off?
If you were to go back a few hundred years where more communities were more isolated and had much lower levels of wealth, you'll find in many cases risk could be catastrophic. So, for instance, in 18th century France, which of course on one side we know it as the country of the philosophes and an intellectual tradition, the royalty, then the revolution. But in that century, there had been 18 general famines and hundreds of local ones. And local famines were really things that happened. If you were a weakly isolated community and you have flooding or a storm or anything that interrupts your local productivity, you most likely had very little buffering. You didn't have much money or communications and signaling infrastructure to bring in surpluses from elsewhere. So you just had to deal with the problem yourself. So you could have, you could very easily be thrown into a crisis. Now, one of the things that happened, particularly as we started to get the energy and the innovation and those, that sort of cycle, is we started connecting more, be it roads, be it waterways, be it communication systems such as markets and weights and measures and more sophisticated complex structures of contracts, etc. And they not only linked up more isolated communities, if you can see it like that, but they also gave economies of scale. They allowed people to specialize, which is more economically efficient. They allowed people to learn new things, share knowledge, combine capital. So you had a thing where risk could be both spread out and shared, and people got wealthier. So in a real sense, that was a really good thing for human welfare. And of course, where we are today is we have, for instance, we're not throwing a dice if a woman goes into labor and say, well, will the child be born? Will the mother die? We largely assume that it's going to go on fine. Our water is clean, our sewerage is removed. We live in warm or good temperatures and environments. All sorts of things that we take for granted, of course, we habituate to them. But all of that is part of what connectivity has brought us, what rising wealth has brought us.
So once a country sets itself on this path to globalization, is there a way back?
Well, it becomes very hard. And again, I think simple examples are best to demonstrate this. One is if you live in an isolated local community, and you start interconnecting with the world and you start taking on debt, you start taking on aspirations because you look at other people and say, well, I can have this. And humans are really quite status conscious. So I look and say, well, my child will go to university, etc. So there are these rising pressures and expectations. But once you start to have things like, for instance, you buy a car or you borrow money so your kid can go to university, if you drop out, you can't pay off your debt and somebody comes and takes away your house and your property and you're in a hole. Or for a country, it starts to invest in infrastructure, so it gets new power plants, etc. And it starts to change its own economy. So, for instance, now that it, say, could import food more, it becomes less reliant on its own food production, and it starts to try and promote other things. But, of course, anything, if you drop out of that, you know, you can end up in a position where you're suddenly food insecure, or you can't pay your debts and your currency collapses and basically you can't buy anything, any food or energy or other things that you become dependent upon. So really it becomes a type of a way of getting trapped into a process. And of course, mostly that process has been good. It's been a process, you know, as I mentioned, where health and welfare and opportunities have increased. So people have said, well, this is a good thing. So in a way, it's kind of a stealth change in dependencies. We don't really see it, but what we're losing is localized resilience all the time. And a step off of that complexity escalator of globalization and integration becomes a very difficult one. And it's also one that, you know, whatever you'll say to your population and saying, well, look, we want to go back and be poorer and less complex, you'll find most of the population will turn around to you and say, well, we don't want to be poorer. We don't want to be in a position where, you know, we have greater risks of disease or childhood mortality or food insecurity. So for all sorts of reasons, it just becomes a hard thing to pull back on.
We're talking with David Korowitz, and we're talking about the possibilities of collapse. Now, when Canadian, American, or French politicians talk about the national economy and what they're going to do, is that just a throwback to a previous age? What is the real role of national politicians now?
You know, this is an interesting one because I think, well, let me give you an example. When Ireland went into an IMF program recently, in the last few years, and that meant that the IMF and had a say in how our economy was run, and there was a great big outburst of anger and anxiety saying, we've lost our sovereignty. It's gone. We've lost it now because we have the IMF in. And of course, what's interesting about this is how what we associate sovereignty with, this little bit of decision making by the IMF coming in. So we've lost our sovereignty, where in fact, we were always deeply, we have been and we are deeply interdependent in the world, number one. And number two, whatever we did with our finances, we're always constrained by bond prices, by budget deficits, or all of those other things that are intimately connected to the rest of the world. So in one way, you know, we're tightly, tightly connected, but sometimes we don't see the connections because we've so habituated to them. We think they're normal. Whereas in fact, if I got a scissors of a sort, a giant scissors, and cut around the United States or cut around Ireland, that ensured nothing came in. No signaling, no imports, no people. Very, very quickly, you'll find the countries collapsing. Infrastructure would start to fall apart. Parts for processes and factories. There'd be all sorts of monetary crises, etc. We're clearly, in terms of our dependencies, deeply integrated. Humans, we don't really see these things. What we see is drama. What we see is tribal interactions. And that's where national politics come in. And of course, in the globalizing process, it's really a self-organizing process. Unless you're a really bad government, you can connect up and your economy, certainly over the last bunch of decades, would have grown, provided you don't do anything stupid. You didn't need any great knowledge of economics to ensure that you could be part of this process. And I think in a way, politics is it does local things, it has some control, but the control is always limited and dependent, and it can never be properly predicted into the future. And we'll see this even with the, you know, even though it was relatively obvious, countries didn't see the credit crisis coming, even though we spend an awful lot of time, governments do, and their populations in a dialogue about, you promised to do X, or you said this would happen, or you predicted that our budget deficit would be so-and-so. And of course, there's a lot of performance here of pretending we understand our control systems. We really don't. But at the same time, we can remain integrated. The system carries us along, this complex interdependent system that self-organizes. So it doesn't really need too much government control.
And I think that's one place where you disappoint some of the conspiracy theorists and those who would like to be angry just at the bankers for our situation. You're saying there's no real organizing power behind the global economy, and if that's true, how does it function?
What we've learned about the global economy, or as I would see it, I see it as a type of ecosystem that we've built around ourselves. And it's massively complex. It works like an ecosystem. For instance, if you go into nature, into a forest ecosystem or wherever, and you'll see all of these different species in their niches, and they're all interacting. There's predators and prey, there's food sources, and there's disease vectors, and there's lots of different niches where different animals and plants can find their home, if that's the word. Now, you could say, well, who's controlling this ecosystem? And of course, what we learned is that actually that it doesn't need a controller. You can have all sorts of complex interrelationships that are dynamic and hugely complex, but it doesn't need a controller. And that's kind of like the globalized economy. Now, there is a slight difference is that humans do, we are able to do some forward planning. We, for instance, organize the building of a city or a space program or whatever. But control is always localized. Now, I don't necessarily mean in place, but an influence through a certain part of a network. And one of the things that keeps us networks going, of course, is this interdependence. But for instance, like bankers, the main reason we bailed out banks was because if banks went down, they would tear down the whole, not just financial system, but they would tear down our supply chains. They'd put huge risks onto critical infrastructures right around the world. So the banks had to be saved. And that, you could say, is okay, all of these things depend on the banks. But the other side of that is, well, all banks are largely trading as abstract future promises. That's the basis of their wealth. We call it wealth. But if everybody called that wealth, in other words, if we wanted to grab our financial assets or our money out of banks, the banks wouldn't have it. They would collapse. So the banks are as dependent on trust as and confidence as the rest of society is dependent upon banks. So it's this like interdependent ecosystem. And even within all of that, I mean, when we talk about sort of conspiracies of governments plotting and planning, what's quite clear is how often on the big things governments are surprised. I don't think people were, the collapse of the Soviet Union largely took people by surprise. Events, for instance, in Japan, when there was the tsunami and the nuclear power station, there's always surprises, events that interrupt anybody's prediction of the future. So I think that one of the things people can be prone to is saying, look, in this chaotic world, here are these people with power. And they say, okay, that must be all plotted and planned for. They must be in control. And it's constructing a narrative out of something which is very human. We like stories. We see in stories. But in fact, what we are doing also is making a story, creating a story out of little bits of a vastly complex interdependent system that we really couldn't capture all its dynamism, all its parts. But the story is like the shorthand, and we're often emotionally attached to it. So I don't see these grand conspiracies so much, though people can try, and people have always tried to do conspiracies, but they're more likely to work in pretty tight environments within pretty closed set of relationships, and they're more likely to unwind the longer time goes on, because just the world, in essence, becomes less predictable because of the whole myriad of uncertainties that one can expect as time goes on to build up in the world.
This is Radio EcoShock. I am Alex Smith, and I'm talking with analyst David Korowitz. And now we're going to move to, we've looked at sort of how things are. Let's look at how they might become. What can we learn about the process of collapse from the fuel blockades in the United Kingdom in the year 2000?
Well, the fuel blockades were, in 2000, the Blair government had really weren't very long in power. and the government wanted to raise diesel duty, which is what the truckers use, and the truckers were outraged, and they blocked the fuel depots around Britain. And very, very quickly, it became apparent that, okay, they're only blocking a few fuel depots. What effect could this have? But what you found is, firstly, those fuel depots were involved in just-in-time resupplying of petrol stations across Britain. And those petrol stations kept the cars and trucks moving all across the country. And within a day or two, half of the petrol stations had run out of petrol, so there were lots of queues. People couldn't get to work. It started to be problems with deliveries. Within a few days more, large parts of deliveries started to be slowed down or weren't happening into factories, or people couldn't get to the factories. And it surprised people then very particularly when supermarkets started to empty and couldn't be resupplied. So this ripple effect started to very slowly at first, in the first day or two, and in the end it was only about 5 days long, 6 days long, the whole process. But what one got was this picture of a slightly accelerating, spreading out of crisis that was effectively starting to shut down all different parts of economic life in Britain. And I understand in the end, more or less, the Blair government were told by the supermarket chiefs who went into Downing Street and said, you know what, we will have a food crisis if this blockade isn't broken very, very soon. And I think the truckers were given, under no uncertain terms, a very severe warning to stop. Now, what out of that came, it really frightened the British government, and it clearly frightened the Canadian government enough because they wrote a report on it. And it was really the first glimpse of something that we took for granted, that all of this complex world that we live in that seems so variable, so adaptive, so resilient, could, if the right parts were hit, start to have these sort of cascading effects. And further studies on this started to indicate that how this process happens, this deep interconnection, and then this spread, because of the connectivity, this spread of failure through networks, is this slow rise. But then they were saying, if this had gone on only a little bit longer, another couple of days, large parts of British manufacturing would have been shut down. And if after 7 or 8 days or whenever, you said if you were to remove the offending blockade, that it could have taken weeks for the economy to recover again. It wouldn't just stop when you removed the blockading truckers. Now, it did finish after 5 days, so it happened. Is it finished before this sort of process would have been expected to really deepen and extend? And since then, from that period, well, the insights that's given, there's been a growing awareness that this sort of interconnectivity, if the right amount or the right part of the globalized economy is hit, you can start to spread failure. And you see little glimpses, for instance, in the Icelandic volcano, in the Thai flooding in 2011, in the Japanese tsunami, where something happens to a factory in Thailand, for instance, and if it produces something that's not easily replaceable, in other words, generally something complex, you can find factories around the world shutting down. So the Japanese tsunami shut down lots of factories in the United States because the critical input wasn't provided. And if those factories didn't have the critical input, well, they can't produce their output. The people might as well go home. And looking at these sort of little interruptions starts to give one a sense of both how we're connected and how globalized everything has become and how high speed all of this just-in-time interdependencies, and also how something, if it was big enough and it hit the right part, could actually start tearing down the operation of the globalized economy itself. And because of our changing dependencies, like we talked about earlier, in countries, you know, you become globalized, your dependencies change, you sort of say goodbye to your localized resilience in the process without really meaning to. Well, we realize that, well, we're all largely dependent on just-in-time systems as our infrastructure has got more and more complex. We talk about the energy, for instance, needed to run a power plant. But of course, a power plant doesn't just need energy. It needs, as it's got more and more complex, lots of other inputs, replacements, consumables, little fixable bits for machinery, etc. So that we have this like a very complex nutrient flow, if you think of it, through the globalized economy, of this thing that needs this complexity feeding all the time of not just resources, but productive things and services, etc. And once they all flow through the globalized economy, largely it works. And also the globalized economy is pretty good at dealing with interruptions. So, for instance, if my shampoo isn't in the supermarket, there's plenty of other shampoos. If I lose a piece for something, if I need, you know, something for my computer, you know, there's lots of places I can go to get that something. So in many cases, you know, our system is very good for small breaks in supply chains, or if factories go down, or if I need a replacement, something or other. So that, you know, that's part of the good resilience of the globalized economy. But it's just what those blockades and subsequent events showed was that, well, if it hits the right place and the right place is big enough or connected enough, you can cause all sorts of trouble globally. And rather than repairing, in other words, fixing itself, it can start to spread breakdown. So it can be, so you can have a crisis in one part of the world or in one system. And, you know, usually the globalized economy is good at fixing itself. But if it hits the right bit, rather than fixing and repairing, it can start spreading contagion through networks that are globalized, and it can happen very fast because of how the speed of our interactions, be it supply chains or financial systems, have got faster and faster and faster. And we've adapted to that speed. So, for instance, you know, because we all live in a world of, by and large, well, not all of us, but we live in a world of supermarkets, of convenient food, you know, we take it all for granted. We don't really carry much food stock at home. It's quite normal, whereas years ago, it was quite normal that you would have had preserves and pickled things, etc. Now we don't. And these sort of changing, so the world's got faster and faster, and we've adapted to that. And in a way, that's made us less and less resilient to breaks, temporal breaks in the flow of things. And that's also part of our vulnerability.
Radio EcoShock will be right back with more from David Korowitz, the Irishman investigating the fragility of global systems and the possibility of a rapid collapse of everything we take too much for granted.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org. This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex, and I'm talking with David Korowitz in Dublin about the chances of a rapid collapse of global systems. Could you paint us a picture? I think you did look into if the Eurozone collapsed. Maybe the Italian banks go under, the Spanish follow shortly thereafter, the Germans can't make up the difference. What would that look like for the average person in the street? How might that develop for us?
What we would see, I suppose, is people would try and keep it quiet. In other words, what was happening. And it would probably hit the world very, very suddenly that people listen on the radio and saying, banks are going down, crisis, crisis, crisis. People go to their bank accounts, to their bank machines and try to take out money, and there's nothing there. People start to panic. And banks or governments start saying, oh, we're going to issue new currency. But people don't know how to value this new currency. So, for instance, you're in Canada, and I want to buy something off you. And you look at me and saying, well, you were using euros. What are you going to give me now? A, do you have euros? B is, if you're introducing a new currency, what is it worth? Or C is, you're going to promise to pay me, but I can't guarantee that you'll be able to, even if you're full of goodwill. So you're not going to send me the piece of the good that I might want. And that has the effect on a larger scale of helping the outside world lose even more confidence in my economy. So you have these feedback cycles. So what we would see here in Ireland is, or in Europe, is banks falling, and actually that would start knocking banks down in the United States and everywhere. We'd all be in a state of chaos. But largely closed banks, interbank transfers would probably freeze. You won't get credit for anything, and shipping credit, trade credit, all sorts of things. So it would be multidimensional. But what would happen is people would then say, well, okay, how do we resupply anything? How do we resupply our supermarket? How do we resupply, I need a new thing for my factory, for the production line, or, you know, I need medicine. But people say, well, nobody can trade. We don't know what we're going to get for this money. We don't know if we'll be paid. I'd rather hold on to something real, the bit of medicine, than have this promise that the person won't be able to deliver on some sort of money or new money or whatever. So what you'd find is this spread of factory production failures, shops that can't be resupplied. And for instance, this factory in Europe that's producing an input into the factory in the United States, well, what happens is a European company can't get an input. That input means it can't produce. The output for that won't go to the United States, which means something in the United States mightn't work or mightn't function. And you start to see that at scale. And then you have this spread across supply chains, across financial networks, and it starts a cycle of lost confidence, of falling production, etc., etc. So really, I think the best way to see it from my perspective is it's kind of like a heart attack. It's a shutdown in the flow. So that sort of rich nutrient flow of goods and services that sustains the global economy starts to slow down and then stop. And that's what I would see a collapse as. The process by which it happens is a shutdown in that flow.
I was first introduced to your work by Nicole Foss, who I know that you know. And my first shallow reaction was to remind me of something I read way back. In 1973, an Italian named Roberto Vacca wrote the doomsday book The Coming Dark Age, and his general theory was that human systems were becoming too complex for us to manage and so would fail. And even though Vacca worked in the computer system business, he didn't see that intelligent technology could supplement our brains so that we could handle complexity. And he was wrong, at least for now. What sets your arguments apart from Vacca?
Well, now, I haven't read Vacca's book, so I can't quite comment directly there. However, even in the 1970s or the 1960s, the world was far more complex. The economy was far more complex than we could understand. And indeed, there's a famous essay written in the early 1950s by an economist, and I can't remember what the economist's name is, but the essay is a great one. It's called I, Pencil. And it really looks at the complexity of a simple pencil and makes the point that nobody could understand or put it all together between the metal and the rubber and all the things that go into it right across the world. So that issue that maybe Vacca was talking about, the world is getting more and more complex in ways we can't under control. Maybe people sometimes say, oh, we can't understand it, therefore we're losing control. In fact, we never had control in the first place. We don't need control. It can self-organize. So in a sense, that fear is a little bit misguided. However, I think one of the things that we have seen is, you know, this escalating coupling, this very tight interconnection, more concentration, be it in banks and other things. And so the argument isn't so much that everything is really complex or it's more complex than we can understand. It's been like that for ages and it's fine. It works just dandy. In fact, it's so stable. We can send when we use a mobile phone with confidence, or when we go into a supermarket and use our card that bounces signals between supermarket systems and retail systems and bank systems through all sorts of networks. These millisecond interactions, times that are all perfectly aligned and attuned. That's a sign of real stability, of real the system working. Nobody knows how it all fits together. Everything works in niches. They come together and something happens that seems to work. So that issue of just pure not understanding or not knowing is all right. The problem really is how things are connected, so the structure of connections. Do you have very concentrated nodes, for instance? Do you have, so that could be an example of, banks that are huge and concentrated, so that if they go, they take it down an awful lot with them. It could be regions that are super critical for the globalized economy, or it could be special infrastructure, critical infrastructures in particular contexts. So I think maybe just from what you were saying there, it's a slightly different issue. We don't really have to fear not understanding everything. But what we do have to fear, I think, is how tightly coupled, how high speed, how interdependent things are. And also the reasons why stress might be growing. And that's the other issue, that the type of things that could knock off this sort of cascading failure are growing hazards. So be they resource constraints like peak oil and very linked up with that food, or it could be just that the financial system itself, in and of itself, has been making extraordinary promises against itself that really can't ever be delivered. So these are all providing ways that weren't so much there in the 1970s by which these sort of interconnected systems could have a bite taken out of them, either a bite in the financial system or exchange or whatever, and could cause some sort of failure.
I'd like to move on to your second paper in a series. It's called Catastrophic Shocks Through Complex Socioeconomic Systems, A Pandemic Perspective. So what could happen with something as simple as an infectious disease?
Well, I did this really because it's not that I'd been working particularly on pandemic diseases, but some people within the US government had seen my work on financial shocks and kind of thought with quite a bit of sense this could be applied to pandemics. So there was an ASEAN meeting in Asia that sort of the US was supporting, high-level meeting with people who would be responsible for managing a pandemic. And I was more or less asked, I think, to go in and scare people so that they could make them realize how important the issue was. So what an infection does, there's been a lot of focus on what happens in a pandemic. And of course, the first thing is people could be hurt, killed, etc. And then there's been research done on, say you're in a hospital, you're running a hospital, you've got to look after people in a pandemic. But what happens in a pandemic? Well, the doctors and nurses can't get in, for instance. So your ability to deal with the situation is compromised. So if you take even a further step out and says, what happens? Well, in a really big pandemic, and in general terms, and I was sort of given these conditions of, what size to look at. And I looked at 20% absenteeism and 40% absenteeism caused by the pandemic. Now, that could be for various reasons, because people are ill or dying, or people are looking after loved ones, or people are just terrified and they don't want to leave their home. So you remove either 20% of people or 40% of people from the population. So the next question is, what happens if you remove that many people? Now, normal economic models don't really see this, but they're quite simple things. Well, the first thing is, if you have a complex company, and let's just imagine a company, but it could be a utility, it could be a power plant, it could be anything else. And if it's a simple company, you can imagine, if you lose 40% of people, company can still do what it's doing. You just maybe produce less of something, or people can stand in for other people and roles. But if you have a very complex organization where there's lots of specialist skills and for the company or the utility to produce an output, what it's meant to do, you need a fair combination of irreplaceable skills. So in other words, you know, it could be software people or it could be technical people that if you remove them, the whole thing can't go ahead, the output can't go ahead. And of course, if the output of a factory or a service can't go ahead, that is a follow-on effect on other factories, that an input for another factory or for other services. So you start to have a spread of absenteeism that's much bigger or can be much bigger than your initial pandemic absenteeism. And you have output failures of goods and services, and they cause cascading effects on other goods and services. And what affects this spread is firstly how complex the society is or the factory is at any different scale. So the more complex it is, i.e. the more irreplaceable people, the more likelihood you are to spread failure. And that failure is sort of, you know, is amplified economically in terms of supply chains, etc. And the more high speed the economy is, i.e. the speed of just in time there is, the speed of flow of goods and services, the faster that is, then the faster your rate of spreading is, that you have to arrest that stop quickly, or, you know, it just runs out of control very quickly. So all of that was kind of indicating that, well, you know, if you had a pandemic flu like what happened in 1919 after the First World War that killed 50 million people, if you had that now, would it have the same effect? Well, you might have the same death rate, for instance. Well, we assume it has the same death rate or whatever. But because our complex society is so much more complex, what it would do to shutting down the flows of systems and other dependencies would be much, much greater. So the socioeconomic impact would be much greater. And that's why on another side, if you use another example of comparing in time, that if you look at before and after the Black Death, so that's in the mid-14th century in Europe, you really don't see much difference in the complexity of society before and after. Now, Europe lost a third of its population thereabouts, but in terms of the goods and services it produced, you don't really see a huge deterioration in the qualities. That's because mostly people were producing food for themselves. So if you lost a producer, you just lost a supplier, you lost a consumer. It's just pretty direct. It doesn't have much wider socioeconomic impacts. And if you were, for instance, a maker of armor or whatever, actually, you know, there was a relatively simple set of skills that were relatively transferable. And really, rather than not being able to produce armor, you just had fewer people producing armor. So we didn't see this drop in complexity. So the complexity issue with the pandemic is really about how our society's changed and how it's become more vulnerable. And of course, the interesting thing is what happens in all of this is that, again, in a big pandemic, you know, this supply chain contagion, the cascading absenteeism through the economy, is the same thing that happens in a big financial shock, which is basically a shutdown in the flow of goods and services. So if you were a risk manager doing a general risk managing a country or a region or a village or wherever, you know, that you have actually a similar outcome. Shutdown flow of goods and services is what you try and manage for actually quite diverse different hazards.
Well, you know, I'm going to ask if a similar study could be done about climate change. I know scientists originally thought that transition would be slow, decades or centuries, but now we've found from the distant past that it can be more rapid, and we've got this risk of megatons of Arctic methane being released, or maybe we've changed the jet stream into a new and hostile weather system. Would we have to rethink climate change as a possible cause of more rapid collapse?
Well, I'm actually doing some work on kind of integrated systems, looking at all of these things together at the moment. And at this moment, I think our immediate risks are the financial system and peaking in oil and food. And I think what will happen there is it will cause major structural damage to the globalized economy. And the next point then is that because even without very rapid climate change, just normally what we're expecting the increase in climate change to be, the impact is going to be much, much harder because we're going to be much, much poorer and we'll have lost adaptive capacity. So, for instance, you'll find in Britain now over the last few months, they've had huge amount of flooding. And I know in the United States, they've had other problems. That could be dealt with. The army comes in or other civil authorities. There's insurance pays out to families whose homes are flooded. Drainage schemes are going to be put in place, etc. That's all of this economy responding with its capacities. And those capacities are dependent on its levels of wealth and complex infrastructures, etc. So what I suspect is that we're going to be much, much poorer when we're going to be hit by climate impacts that previously we could have dealt with, but the same ones now we won't because it'll just knock us sideways. It'll be too much for us. That's how I see the process, less climate change collapsing civilization. I think a lot of civilization is going to be very in great trouble before the major effects of climate change kick in. But the danger there is, of course, because life will still go on, is one of the things that people are going to be struggling with is in a world of growing climate risk and everything else and being much poorer, is one thing they might do is, in a desperate attempt to keep things going, undermine their localized environmental and other resources to the detriment of their future capacity to survive. Or another thing is poor societies have to deal with mass migrations of people, you know, and it doesn't even have to be across countries. For instance, if countries couldn't deal with massive flooding, you might find a load of flooding refugees move within a country and say, turn up on people's doorsteps and say, well, we've no homes. So all of these sort of things. So it's less that climate change will collapse civilization. It's just going to be something that we're already going to be in probably in a pretty rotten state, and it'll just make things harder and harder and harder. Now, if something really rapid happened, like, for instance, you know, a shutdown in the Gulf Stream or some of these sort of very things that might happen over a year or two, yeah, if northwestern Europe froze, that would have the same sort of effect as a financial shock. It would just spread because it couldn't produce, it would affect the financial system, etc., and you would shut down the globalized economy pretty pronto. But that would have to be a very big climate impact. And my feeling is we're not going to get those sort of big impacts before our economy is already pretty destroyed.
Radio EcoShock.
Now, we're starting to approach the end of our time together, so I have to ask you, you've told audiences around the world, quote, we're going into a major systemic collapse. Are you sure?
Well, how would I put it on this? I do, in general, I try and talk about risk and risk management, and I would never say I'm sure of anything. What I'm trying to say, really saying, is not so much I'm sure, but firstly, the fronts of risk, the hazards that we might face are growing. Risks are growing, and our vulnerability, because of how our economy is structured, our globalized economy, our vulnerability is growing. And all of these things together would suggest to me that really there's an escalating risk of big changes, big shocks. You know, it could be the case that we turn around a corner and you are talking to me 30 years from now, and you kind of we are living in a world of abundance and, you know, not too much trouble, and I'll quite happily say, you know, yes, that was my youthful dalliance with doom, but I don't think so. I think the risks are there, and I'm very much of the view that, you know, you don't really have to be sure of anything in risk management. You just have to be able to say, is there a risk that's worth risk managing? And if you're wrong, well, you're wrong, but it's good practice just to keep an eye on things. If you're right, it could make a huge difference to how societies deal with things.
But we're building more and more towards globalization. I mean, the system's just blowing up like a balloon. So what do you tell people? What can they do?
At this stage, I think that there's two sides. One, I'm trying to say to people, at a level of individuals and societies, that where we are as a global community, as people on our planet Earth, we've walked ourselves into what Ronald Wright, a fellow Canadian of yours, I think, called a progress trap. That we all did it. It wasn't done by the rich or the financial system or whatever. It's embodied in how we live in the world and the things we take for granted, our clean water, our roads, our computers and all of these sort of things. And what I'm kind of saying on one side to people is we've got to learn if there are big changes, we're going to need to be really kind of careful about how we deal with these things as a society. So we don't lose ourselves in anger or rage, that we don't destroy resources in whacking each other rather than trying to build a better and more secure future for each other. And that we should kind of accept it with, you know, and learn to let go. So very much at the psychological side. The other part of what I'm trying to do in terms of messaging and helping people with isn't so much we can turn this thing around, or if you do X, Y, and Z, we're going to stop it all happening. I think these are huge, vast, complex processes that we're really more passengers in than drivers. But we can do simple things at various levels that can help our own resilience as societies at various levels. So part of that is dealing with a crisis of how do you manage a crisis? How do you manage a monetary shock? How do we talk to each other? How do we talk to communities? How do we ensure food moves through the system and that food continues to be produced as best as possible in the year or two following a shock or a crisis? And also trying to get people in a way to kind of rehearse these sort of things in their own head to some degree, so that if they come, rather than being people startled in headlights, that people are saying, I know what's happening here. This is the type of things we have to do. We've got to look after food, water, health, whatever. And, you know, it hopefully will help some people be able to lead or give guidance to others as they deal with what would be a huge and disorientating shock. So I think there's lots to be done for those who can see it as a risk that needs to be managed. But as I say, I don't come to anybody and say, look, if you do these three things or this set of things, we're going to turn everything around. I just say, here we have a collective responsibility, and, you know, without beating ourselves up or saying we're bad or wrong or whatever, or anybody else is bad or wrong, you know, let's just get with the program and try and work out the best way for us all to deal with the troubles ahead, because I have a feeling there'll be people scraggling around in this planet for a long, long time into the future. And I think they're going to be telling stories about this period and these decades that we're going into, because it will be such a shock. And, you know, I'm hoping that when they look back, they'll kind of turn back at all of us and say, well, you know, in some ways they screwed up, but when the chips were down, by and large, they did a good job. And that's why, as they look back, we're here today, you know, so.
Here's hoping. We've been visiting with the unique David Korowitz. He's the Dubliner who explores our path towards a rapid collapse of the global system. You can and should read his two key papers on his website, davidkorowitz.com, and that's spelled K-O-R-O-W-I-C-Z. His key papers for this discussion are Trade-Off, Financial System Supply Chain Cross-Contagion, A Study in Global Systemic Collapse, and Catastrophic Shocks Through Complex Socioeconomic Systems, A Pandemic Perspective. Find links to David and these papers in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.info. David Korowitz, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Alex. Thanks for having me.
I'm Alex Smith. Radio EcoShock is listener-supported radio. My thanks to those who help keep it going. Find links for today's show in my blog at ecoshock.info, published every Wednesday. Download this program and all our past programs as free MP3s from our website at ecoshock.org. As we close up shop today, I've got one last musical comment on the push to distract everyone with a new version of the old Cold War. The TV talking heads and right-wing politicians want you to get pumped up for a new enemy, 1984 style. Never mind the weather has gone strange. A nice little war with some fat military spending might cover up the holes in our economy, the shady banks, and all the coal and oil we burn every day. Feel free to use my new song in any way you like except selling it. I'm Alex Smith. Thank you so much for listening to Radio EcoShock and caring about your world. Are we burning up the future? Killing off the past? Let's have a war and make it go fast. Let's have a war, we'll rule the day. Let's have our war, we'll make them pay. You don't know what to do, get that far. It's alright, we'll have a war. Filling up the oceans, filling up the air, ducking all the weather bombs. Hey, let's have a war, we'll rule the day. Let's have a war, we'll make them pay. Let's have a war, we'll make them pay. The air, ducking the weather bomb. Let's have a war. Let's have a war. We'll rule the day. We'll have a war. We'll make the bay. Let's have a war. We'll make the bay. Let's have a war till the judgment day.